Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Steve Jobs, what he meant, and more importantly, how it got that way. The other 99% on the broadcast today, and riding down Sunset Boulevard, the economy on a bus from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Vast Conference, conference calls that give you clarity, professionalism, and flexibility all at a low price. For two Vast Conference calls free with no commitment, go to vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday today, the 6th of October. Good as always to have you with us. There's a book on the bookshelf in my office. It's called The Cult of Mac. It's left over from the guy who had the office before me. But it's not a bad start to our coverage of Steve Jobs today. Cult is kind of a strong word, but it's not far off the mark. You don't hear the kinds of things being said about Apple and Steve Jobs today being said about Dell and Michael Dell or Nike and Phil Knight. Nobody's going to be leaving flowers and candles outside of a Verizon store anytime soon. But long before Steve Jobs ever got sick, people, and you know who you are, were calling themselves Mac people. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith explores how Jobs and Apple managed to make personal computers so personal.
Outside of the Apple store in Soho, Colin Bartlett adds a red apple and a letter to a growing shrine of flowers and candles. Bartlett has two iPhones, an iPad, and two MacBooks. He says part of why he's been so moved by Steve Jobs' death is his experience with these products.
I think it's that empathy, that feeling that you get when you use it. You know, it makes you feel like the company that built it cares about you.
Making people feel like it cares is exactly why Apple is Apple, says Jen Drexler, a brand analyst at Just Ask a Woman.
You joined it. It's like enrolling in college and wearing the sweatshirt. Like, you joined this brand the second you became hooked on one of the products.
Part of it is the cool factor. Drexler says instead of focusing on selling to businesses and targeting the cubicle culture, Mac aimed its products at musicians, filmmakers, and visual artists.
And then everybody else who has one can feel that little bit of that, too. I mean, I can tell you I've never done anything creative with mine ever, but I would like to believe people think I do.
And once you buy into that perception, it's hard to get out. Apple's products have never played very well with others. PC documents won't open on your Mac. Your iTunes songs won't load on your Android phone. All of which creates an aura of superiority, says consumer behavior consultant Britt Beamer.
Part of that non-compatibility was kind of a snob appeal that Apple also created for their customers.
Beamer points out that Apple products also quickly become incompatible with themselves. For instance, if you buy a new iPhone, it won't work with your 4-year-old MacBook Pro. And when you finally break down and buy a new laptop, you will discover that it no longer syncs up with your old iPod. At least that's what I hear. Beamer says this cycle, vicious though it feels, is exactly what Apple's consumers thrive on. That short lifespan makes Apple's products synonymous with what's new and what's cool, which kind of makes you cool.
People discard an Apple product to get the new Apple product. If you had an Apple product, you always had the latest technology.
Beamer did a series of consumer studies for Steve Jobs back in the 80s. He says even then, Jobs wanted people to get emotionally attached to their machines.
He said, the day when people put their wedding pictures in their computer is the day that I know we've won.
In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Tim Cook's officially been the CEO at Apple for about a month or so now, but really, today's day one of the Tim Cook era. Steve Jobs left behind a company in great shape. Plenty of cash, lots in the product pipeline, but lots of challenges too. Marketplace's Steve Henn lays out some of the biggest.
Close your eyes for a second and imagine you have Tim Cook's job.
This is not an easy job.
Shauna Slack founded Genesis Advisors, a consulting firm that specializes in CEO transitions.
It's a really tough act to follow.
Cook has lots of advantages, but no matter what he does, the comparisons are going to be brutal. Brian Blair is an analyst at Wedge Partners. He says what Tim Cook and other Apple executives need to do now is focus on what they can control, the business.
The biggest challenge for them is going to be continuing to grow the two key product lines, iPhone and iPad right now.
Although Apple looms large in the public's mind, its market share is still relatively small. Sure, the iPad's the most popular tablet on the market, but it's a small market. And the competition is coming. The iPhone accounts for just 5% of the global cell phone market. But Blair says the company is making moves to change that.
They're finally attacking every single price point.
No one's really written much about this, but starting this month, you'll be able to get an iPhone 3GS in the US for free, with a contract. And Blair says Jobs didn't just build great products, he built a great team.
And I think that that's what's important, is that each one of these guys is expert in their areas.
And you think they'll stay?
I think they will stay. I do.
Shauna Slack says ensuring that is Tim Cook's first test.
That as a CEO and as the CEO of Apple, that is always your challenge. Your challenge is to create a compelling vision, and it's to sell it to the market, to sell it to employees, and to sell it to customers.
Starting now. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
More buying than selling on Wall Street today. It's a three-day rally. If you're keeping track, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. The now standard 30-year mortgage in this country has been around for 70 years, plus or minus. Still, I'm not sure the following words have ever been strung together to form a complete sentence. The mortgage finance company Freddie Mac said today the average rate on a 30-year fixed is 3.94%. 3.94%. And that's the average rate, right? So you'd expect to find a lot of people are paying well under 4% right now. As usual, though, it pays to read the fine print, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Less than 4%? Is that for real? I called Jeff Gunther with Prosperity Mortgage. Are any of your clients getting conventional loans for under 4%?
Not without paying points.
Paying points means paying a fee up front to lower your interest rate. Each point is 1% of the loan's value. Not worth it, Gunther says, unless you plan to stay in your house several years. Still, he says you'll see a lot of ads these days for 30-year fixed mortgages below 4%.
It's called a leader ad, you know, and people run them to get the phone to ring. Oh, you want that rate? Well, that rate's with a point. Let me give you the rate without the points.
And here's where the fine print comes in. That 3.94% average from Freddie Mac comes with a fee of almost 1 point. Frank Notaft is chief economist at Freddie Mac. He says including that fee, the effective average interest rate on that 30-year fixed is closer to 4.1%. That's still insanely low, right?
Oh my gosh, it's incredibly low. What a bargain.
And some people are managing to pay less than that. Josh Fody is general manager of the restaurant Riley's Oyster in Baltimore. He just locked in a rate for a $200,000 loan backed by the Federal Housing Administration.
I got a 3.75 fixed for 30 year.
No points. And his credit is good, but not great.
I was really surprised, you know, about fell out of my chair. It's just a great rate.
Apparently, it's going to take more than cheap money and low home prices to get more people like Fody in the market. Mortgage applications fell last week. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The Occupy Wall Street protests continued today. They made it all the way to the White House, in fact, in question form, anyway, at the president's press conference this morning.
I think people are frustrated, and you know, the protesters are giving voice to a more broad-based frustration about how our financial system works.
The president said broad-based right there, which brings us to a website called We Are the 99%. It's protesters who say in great personal detail how despite doing what everybody says you've got to do, get an education, work hard, they're falling behind, while the other 1%, the rich, just get richer. Much has been made here and elsewhere of Occupy Wall Street lacking specificity, of being just against things. So we wondered whether those stories from the 99% might provide a clue as to what Occupy Wall Street is for. We sent John Dimsdale out to a rally in Washington today to find out.
Who are we? The 99%! Who are we? The 99%!
From the sounds of today's rally on Pennsylvania Avenue, the movement includes people with a whole lot of different demands. David Barrows was there in a tux and wearing a plastic pig snout.
I'm protesting the corporate, well, what we got is government by bribery, corporate, super transnational corporate bribery.
Nearby, Sherman Taylor thinks the government should impose a maximum wage. Otherwise, he says, the dispossessed will have to take matters into their own hands.
every time throughout history that someone gets too poor, they commit crimes against the rich.
To find out who was bringing these various causes together, I asked around for an organizer of today's rally, and I was finally directed to Margaret Flowers.
This was our intention, was to bring together people who advocate on a broad range of peace and social justice issues, because singly, we're not able to take on the corporate stranglehold of our political process.
And the name of the organization is?
We are not an organization. There is no organization in charge of this. We're adamant about that.
Flowers says the non-organization has 15 committees that will identify the crises that face the country.
By the end of this, we're going to come up with a document that addresses each of these crises with specific changes that we want to see. That's our path that we follow forward to take action to make these things happen.
In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The Oprah Winfrey Network was launched this past winter in what you can only call a frenzy of anticipation and, it must be said, Oprah adoration. Since then, though, the OWN, or OWN, as insiders call it, has done nothing. They've got programming problems, they've got ratings problems, they've got just problems. OWN begins its new season this coming Monday. Oprah herself will be on the air more. Rosie O'Donnell is going to have a show. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins has our story.
When the Oprah Winfrey Network launched, Oprah's fans tuned in for about a month. Since then, ratings are down 30%. Elaine Rapping of SUNY Buffalo says it's not tough to see why.
Unless you really are interested in Oprah, you're going to find the kind of thing she does on many other cable networks of all kinds, really.
Talk shows, documentaries, reality shows, and starting Monday, this TV veteran.
It's me, Rosie O'Donnell. Not Kathy Bates and not Roseanne Barr. People sometimes in the mall mistake me for them.
Rapping says prospects might be better with mistaken identity.
Rosie O'Donnell is very old school, and people, I think, have had enough of Rosie O'Donnell.
To promote Rosie and other shows, the network is doubling down, spending big, reportedly $15 million to market the new shows. Media analyst Derek Bain of SNL Kagan says the big push is because right now, OWN's giving itself away for free. But it wants to start charging cable operators carriage fees roughly on par with a network like Bravo.
They're going to have to get the ratings up significantly in order to justify paying that high of a fee.
Which means, says UCLA media management professor Nelson Gayton, the network needs a lot of, well, Oprah.
She may have to have more of a presence in her own programming.
And now that she's wrapped up her daytime talk show, fans may get a network that lives up to its name. All Oprah, all the time. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Coming up, the things you learn about jobs and the economy riding the bus down Sunset Boulevard.
I mean, I feel like they kind of counsel you into do what you like, do what you love. So I just picked English and then later on realized that maybe that wasn't the best choice.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks rose for a third straight day, boosted by retail sales and calmer nerves over in Europe. The Dow Industrial is up 183 points, 1 2/3%, finished at 11,123. NASDAQ picked up 46 points, about 1 9/10%, closed at 2506. The S&P 500 cranked up 20 points, 1.8%, settled at 1164. In honor of Steve Jobs, we thought we'd take a look at the man and his company by the numbers, as we like to say. 11 billion, the number of files purchased on iTunes. 62.3 million, the number of iPads sold. 357 is the number of Apple stores around the globe. 338 is the number of patents that bear his name. And more personally, 501, the kind of Levi jeans he wore. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Vast Conference, the service that gives clarity, professionalism, and flexibility for conference calls at a low price. Vast provides both regular and toll-free numbers so you can set up calls anytime and provides web tools to manage or record calls instantly. Priced at 2.5 cents per minute with no commitments or contracts, try Vast Conference with two free calls at vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace. That's vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace.
If
on the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. We look back at the employment situation for September. The Labor Department issues numbers. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to release consumer credit data for August. And the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize is announced in Oslo, Norway. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We mentioned this earlier, how the Occupy Wall Street protests have been growing the past week or so. Well, I talked to Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas the other day about where things might lead and who the protesters are. Mike Kelly heard that. He wrote from Montpelier, Vermont to say, in essence, go find out for yourself.
You mentioned that it didn't seem like the protesters were downtrodden. And I was surprised to hear you didn't offer any evidence for this, because it seems to me that you're perpetuating a myth that the protesters are disconnected from economic hardship.
In that light, here's another plug for the website we mentioned in the John Dimsdale piece. We are the 99%. It's called Stories About People Who Did Everything Right Are Still Being Squeezed. The Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy ended late last month, and we did a story about some gay former military who were looking to re-up. One reason, they say, is the bad job market. John McKinnon from Bangor, Maine, says the repeal is a huge step, but for gay veterans, equality is still a ways away.
When a gay service member is successful in reenlisting, they're going to be at a significant disadvantage, especially if they're married. Thanks to DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, gay military spouses will have no health care, no commissary, no housing allowance.
We told you the other day Bank of America is going to start charging customers $5 a month for using their debit cards at some point next year. B of A shares and its fortunes have been hurting, so the fee is one way for the bank, it says, to replenish its coffers. A lot of you wrote in expressing outrage. Valerie Anderson from Casey, South Carolina, did something about it.
I opened a Bank of America credit card account, and I'm going to use that credit card like I use my debit card, and then I will just pay the balance off every month, and there should be no fees.
There should be no fees, she said. Here's hoping. If you've got a personal finance tip or anything else you want us to know, write to us, marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. The next milepost telling us where we are in this economy comes our way at 8:30 tomorrow morning. Maybe a clue as to when this jobs crisis is going to turn around. The September unemployment report hits the streets, ironically enough, just as people are heading off to work for the day, if they're lucky enough to have work. Because 2+ years into this recovery, 1 in 10 people who want a job can't get a job. It's even worse out here in California, 12% joblessness. But not everybody's out of work. And even if they are, they've still got places to go. So today, we're going to go with them on the bus, the Sunset Boulevard line, to be exact. So here we are, the beginning of Sunset Boulevard. Runs 26 miles that-a-way. That-a-way is west, by the way. Starting downtown, the number 2 bus travels through the working-class neighborhoods of the East Side. It goes into Hollywood, the economic engine of Los Angeles, down through Beverly Hills and on to UCLA, all the way out to the beach on the Pacific Ocean. We wanted to get not so much a snapshot, really, more of a slice of the changing economy. A look at what's working and what needs to work better so that more people can work. So you look out the window and what do you see? You see Blessed Sacrament School, you see Blessed Sacrament Church, dentists and cleaners and Pizza Huts.
Approaching Sunset and Echo Park.
Darling Sienna boards the 2 bus in Echo Park, just west of downtown. Breakfast is still in her hands. It's a quick bite and a large coffee from McDonald's. What do you do?
I'm an administrative assistant for UCLA.
Oh, excellent. So obviously you're riding the bus all the way out there.
I do.
That's 15 miles out Sunset to campus. 2 hours each way, every day, for $36,000 a year. She's a single mom, 2 teenagers.
Do I live check to check? Yeah, I do.
How long has it been like that?
Since I had my kids, since I started working.
16 years it's been like that.
Pretty much.
Check to check.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't you tired?
I'm tired. I want to go back to school. I want to make more money, but just not possible right now.
Maxwell Fleming hops on the bus on a stretch of Sunset that runs through an area called Silver Lake. He's a young guy, 30-ish, burly with a big bushy beard, and a resume not uncommon in this neighborhood of hipsters and artists. What do you do?
I'm a writer and an illustrator.
Tell me more.
Well, right now I'm trying to illustrate children's books, and I write articles for a online website, and I'm working on a screenplay.
So it seems like this is a great example of what a lot of economists call the gig economy. You're moving from gig to gig to gig.
Yeah, the ultimate freelance journey. But as soon as I get burnt out in the rat race, I'm going to pack up my luggage and move on.
Stop requested. Please use rear exit.
Hollywood Center Motel, where the neon is clearly broken. Looks like Norman Bates' house. That's horrifying. The number 2 bus, with us on it, pulls up to the corner of Sunset and Vine. It's practically the heart of Hollywood. The town, that is. But Hollywood, the industry, is global, like so many other industries. And like so many of the economic problems facing the world. Amoeba Music, CNN, the Arclight Theater, Kim Kardashian on the billboard. Advertising Midori. Go figure that out. Can I have a big glass of iced tea? That'd be great. Thanks a lot. So here's what we did. It's lunchtime. We're hungry. We got off the bus. We're at the Waffle in Hollywood, right on Sunset, to talk about Hollywood.
Hollywood is basically growing with the growth of the world economy, not with the growth of the U.S. economy.
That's John Blank. He works for the Los Angeles County Economic Development Corporation. He's an economist there. And he says the entertainment industry's doing all right. The world wants more American movies and television. They want our technology. And believe it or not, they want other things that we make as well. Because in places like China and India, economies are still growing. And Blank figures that could mean more jobs for Americans. Businesses, he says, in developing countries have lots of money. And they want to spend it here.
There's this company called Rhapsody in Korea. They make Korean-sourced and manufactured apparel in Korea. But now they want to get made-in-California apparel shipped to Korea. So there you see that there could come jobs back in Los Angeles and restore that part of the economy.
New jobs, someday. A turning point, even, but only for the right kinds of workers.
It's 4.5% unemployment for college-educated people. It's 16% unemployment if you do not have access to a college education. No education, no writing skills, no math skills, no ability to do any of the salaried jobs that are in the service economy.
A college education is one way to break into a global workforce. It's not a guaranteed job, but there is a whole slew of wannabe workers giving it a go just down Sunset Boulevard at UCLA.
UCLA, please use rear exit.
So here we are, corner of Hillgard and Westholm. There's the Gamma Phi Beta house over there. UCLA sweatshirts everywhere. Today, the first day of school. It's the first full week of classes at UCLA anyway. But English major Karen McDonough is already thinking about what comes next.
I'm 21, senior at UCLA.
And you're graduating?
Yes.
So you're screwed.
Absolutely.
There's always been a balance between doing what's practical and following your dream. But in a state with 12% unemployment, perhaps the scale should be tipped a bit toward the practical? So 3.5 years ago when you started at UCLA, what were you thinking?
I mean, I feel like they kind of counsel you into do what you like, do what you love. If you enjoy it, you're going to be good at it. And so I just picked English and then later on realized that maybe that wasn't the best choice.
So would you basically take any job?
Yes, I would. Absolutely.
Give us your name, would you?
Lindsay Sharp.
Lindsay Sharp, also a senior. Also looking for a job. Not as nervous, though, as our English major, because she's an engineer.
I don't face the same degree of uncertainty as a lot of my peers do.
Do you feel bad that you're basically, you've got a plan and everybody else is, ah?
It can be interesting at times, but I had several friends, computer science majors in particular, they were getting offered $35 an hour as summer interns before they even have their bachelor's degree.
So if your dream career wasn't practical, if you didn't make the right choice the first time around, maybe it's time to switch gears. To find a way to make it in this economy. After it leaves UCLA, the 2 bus runs through some of the richest neighborhoods in town. Places like Westwood and Brentwood and Pacific Palisades. But you get past those neighborhoods, down at the end of the line, and you're here, where Sunset Boulevard hits the ocean. It's a couple of businesses, a seafood restaurant, a grocery store, and then the beach. And it occurs to me here that the ocean's not a bad metaphor. Here you go. There are jobs coming to this economy. The hard part is knowing when that tide's going to turn. So that's Los Angeles and a slice of California. You can find out where your state stacks up with an interactive map on our website. You can explore and compare the employment picture in your state. It's at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, ending as we started with Steve Jobs, this time in his own words. This is from a commencement address he gave at Stanford University back in 2005, not long after his first cancer surgery.
For the past 33 years, I have looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I am about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart.
Steve Jobs, 6 years ago. And that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Thursday. Today, the Dow climbed 183 points, 1 2/3%. The NASDAQ picked up 46 points, about 1.9%. The S&P 500 gained 20 points, 1.8%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, all the morning's business news. Also, Jeremy Hobson's live from London talking to the Greek foreign minister about what's going on there. And coming up back here next time, you need a good worker? Hey, hire a soldier.
You tell a veteran to go out and dig a ditch with a spoon, they're going to figure out how to do it.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.